Hi, this is Wayne Ivey, pastor of First Christian Conroe. Welcome to my Thursday podcast. I'm recording this on Wednesday, November the 4th, and the election is over, but we still don't know who is president for the next 4 years. I want you to promise me something. For those of you who are going to be happy when the winner is announced, I want you to be magnanimous in victory. And for those of you who will be saddened when the winner is pronounced, I want you to be gracious in defeat. Don't you think it's time we just all got along together? I believe so. Well, we are studying the book of Mark, and this week I believe we are beginning with the third chapter. Remember that Mark is the oldest and the shortest of the Gospels, written around A.D. 60, give or take. You know that probably the authors of both Matthew and Luke had a copy of the Gospel of Mark when they wrote their Gospel, and it was used as source material for both of them, for Matthew and Luke. Mark is the Gospel that does not have the Christmas story in it. Neither does the Gospel of John, but it was written way later in the first century. So let's see what we can learn today from the third chapter of the Gospel of Mark. Hear these words from the third chapter of Mark's Gospel. I'll be reading the first 6 verses. Again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. And they watched him to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Come here." And he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?" But they were silent, and he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Why do you suppose that Jesus went into the synagogue on the Sabbath? Well, to worship and to pray, of course. Jesus was Jewish and had practiced his faith since childhood. Jesus must have felt the weight, the responsibility for all of humanity on his shoulders. The comforting spiritual presence in the synagogue was what he needed to pray, to listen to the rabbis, to inhale the pleasing aroma of the incense. He may have needed to recharge his own spiritual batteries. But the needs of humanity were always in front of him, and the religious leaders were always waiting to trap him. But he turned their intentions around on them. "Which is better, to do good or do harm?" he asked them somewhat sarcastically. "What is more important?" he was asking. "The letter of the law or the spirit of the law?" Did his answer anger the Pharisees so? I think it was because their very way of life depended on upholding the letter of the law regardless. Mark said that he was angered, that he was grieved at their hardness of heart. Jesus saw great potential for good in humanity, yet he grieved for their lack of compassion. How often do you and I get all huffy and start trying to explain how right we are in a given situation, when the better course of action would just be to acknowledge the other person as a lovable child of God and let it go at that? We don't have to win every argument or prove that we are right in every circumstance. That has become almost the definition of what it means to be a Pharisee, has it not? And we continue with chapter 3 at verse 7. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, also from Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea, and from beyond the Jordan and from Tyre and Sidon. A great multitude, hearing all that he did, came to him. And he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they should crush him. For he had healed many, so that all who had diseases pressed upon him to touch him. And whenever the unclean spirits beheld him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." And he strictly ordered them not to make him known. And he went up into the hills and called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he appointed 12 to be with him and to be sent out to preach and to have authority to cast out demons. Simon, whom he surnamed Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, whom he surnamed Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder. Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. While Christian tradition often refers to the apostles as being 12 in number, different gospel writers give different names for the same individual, and apostles mentioned in one gospel are not mentioned in another. James, John, and Peter were the closest to him. Thomas would be known as the doubter, Judas Iscariot, who would betray him. But Judas was still one of the closest to him. You could tell that it broke Jesus' heart during the Last Supper. They were his A-team. Question, do you have an A-team? Everyone needs a group of individuals whom they trust. Who do you trust? My A-team is right here at FCCC. A church family can grow bonds of trust among its members. Think about it. I'll just bet that there are those here in our church family whom you trust and whom you call on when your ox is in the ditch, figuratively speaking, of course. I encourage you to nourish those bonds of trust that bind you to one another. If you don't think you have an A-team here, then get busy. It's important to establish close, loving friendships. There are folks here at FCCC just waiting to be on your A-team. Over the centuries, the students of Mark's gospel have found that the verses from 20 until the end of the chapter in this chapter 3 are troubling, to say the least. I think you'll understand why. Listen to this passage. I'm reading from verse 20 through the end of the chapter. Then he came home. And the crowd came together again so that they could not even eat. And when his friends heard it, they went outside to seize him, for they said, "He is beside himself." And the priests who came down from Jerusalem said, "He is possessed by Beelzebul, and by the prince of demons. He casts out demons, and he calls them to him," and said to them in parables, "How can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot not stand, but is coming to an end. But no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man. Then indeed he may plunder the house. Truly I say to you, all sins will be forgiven the sons of men and whatever blasphemies they utter. But whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit never has forgiveness, but is guilty of an eternal sin. For they had said, 'He has an unclean spirit.' And his mother and his brothers came standing outside. They sent to him and called him. And the crowd was sitting about him. And they said to him, 'Your mother and your brothers are outside asking for you.' And he replied, 'Who are my mother and my brothers?' And looking around on those who sat about him, he said, Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. In Jesus' day, it was not unusual for a healer to be casting out unclean spirits. It was also not particularly unusual that one might be accused of being in league with Satan or Beelzebul. Jesus turned that argument back around on them, that Satan could not be against himself, he couldn't stand. But what Jesus was really doing in this passage was stating his independence from his earthly family. This is a sad part of Mark's gospel. Jesus knew that he had chosen a lonely path. He needed the 12 apostles as helpers in his ministry, but he knew that he would not be a part of his earthly family much longer. And so he almost mocked them. He said, "Who is my family?" "Anyone who does the will of God." But if we look at the behavior of Jesus from a purely human point of view, from his family's point of view, it's easy to understand why they went out and they said he is beside himself. Think about it for a moment. Jesus had left home and just walked away from his carpenter's business at Nazareth. Jesus was obviously on his way to a head-on collision with all of the orthodox leaders of his day. Jesus had started a society of his own. He had called these 12 to go with him, and they went off and stayed in the mountains, and he preached and taught. He had thrown away security. He had thrown away safety. He had shown himself completely indifferent to the verdict of society. It's no small wonder then his friends and his family would think that he was, as they put it, beside himself. And then finally, there's this troubling passage of Jesus when he says, "Whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit never has forgiveness, but is guilty of an eternal sin." You know, in my younger days, I've told you this, I preached a sermon about sort of this subject, and the title of the sermon was unfortunate. The title of the sermon was, "Will I Meet Hitler in Heaven?" Oh, my goodness, yeah, it was awful. But my point was this, is our ability to sin greater than God's capacity to love? In the end, will all of God's creation be reconciled to God in eternity? I don't know. I can only use my new theological concept that is becoming more apparent the older I get. And that theological concept is just this: wait and see. Yeah, I know, that was not a totally satisfactory answer to the toughest of life's questions, but that's all I got today. I can't wait to see you this weekend. I look forward to us being in worship together. However, I completely understand if you're just not comfortable being in worship with that many people. But be sure and tune in to our Sunday worship podcast and know that you will be held in our prayers as we gather for worship. I look forward to greeting you soon. Have a good day. God bless.